Chapter 5. The Admiral was pleased with the Commodore, as well he might be, for not only had Jack captured one of the four powerful French frigates that so disturbed Mr. Bertie's peace of mind, and retaken two Indiamen together with a useful 18-gun sloop, not only had he destroyed one of the strongest French bases in the Indian Ocean, doing so with such briskness that the Admiral's dispositions would be admired even in Whitehall, which always called for quick results, but he'd also enriched Mr. Bertie to the extent of several thousand pounds. Just how many thousand it was impossible to say until a tribe of officials 6,000 miles away should have set a value on a prodigious number of objects, such as the 320 pikes, 40 rammers, and 40 sponges taken at St. Paul's. But in any case, Admiral Bertie would eventually receive 1/12 of the total sum that they arrived at, without having stirred hand or foot, without having given any advice more valuable than a general exhortation to go in and win, he'd acquired a considerable addition to his fortune. And ever since his first charming conference with Captain Corbett, the forerunner of the squadron, he'd spent the chief of his time in drawing up detailed plans for new stabling and a pine house at Langton Castle, where he lived, while, in default of the coronet for which she longed, Mrs. Bertie should have a suit of lace. Yet although the Admiral was, perhaps, a little devious beneath his bonhomie, he had a grateful heart. A fairly grateful heart. At least he was no gripe farthing. And the moment the Raisonnable was signalled, he began to lay on a feast, sending two boats away to the westward for lobsters, his favourite dish. As he led the Commodore towards this glowing spread, which was attended by almost all the eminent men and all the beautiful women of Cape Town, so long as they were white, he said, "How happy I am to see you back so soon, Aubrey, and how very well things have turned out. I sent Corbett straight home with your splendid news as soon as I dashed off my covering letter. You'll have a gazette to yourself, I'm sure. What a pretty ship she is, too, your Bourbonnais. Fine, narrow entry and as stiff as a steeple. I wish our yards could turn them out like that. Yet, after all, if you young fellows take 'em ready-made, it saves our shipwright's time, eh? I confirmed her new name, by the by, and shall confirm all your appointments. I'm glad Clonfort's made post, though that was a sad, unlucky stroke with the company's silk. I dare say you keel-hauled him for it at the time. Still, 'tis of no use crying over spilt milk, as I always tell Mrs. Bertie. That all's well that ends well. Clonfort's made post, and you've taken four thumping prizes and half a dozen little ones. You didn't see anything else on your way down, I suppose, just for the bonne bouche, as they say. Well, sir, we sighted that Russian sloop Diana beating about off Rodriguez, but I thought I should best fall in with your views by disregarding her. The Admiral didn't seem to hear. After a momentary absence, he went on, "Well, and so you knocked their batteries about their ears. I'm glad of it, and Farquhar's cock-a-hoop, as far as a dry sticker man like that can be cock-a-hoop. Drinks no wine, and the water's rotted all the joy out of him. I didn't ask him to this dinner. In any case, he declines all invitations. He's longing to see you, however, and your Dr. Maturin. For the next bite, once Rodriguez is reinforced, he's Bourbon for good and all. Or La Réunion, or Ile Bonaparte, as they call it. Damn fools. This chopping and changing's typical of your foreigner, don't you find, Aubrey? That should be with the next monsoon, as long as transports can be provided for 3,000 or 4,000 men. What kind of man is this Dr. Maturin, may I ask? Is he to be trusted? He looks something of the foreigner to me. Oh, I believe he's quite trustworthy, sir. said Jack, with an inward grin. Lord Keith has a great opinion of him, offered him to be physician of the fleet. And the Duke of Clarence called him in when the whole faculty was at a stand. He thinks the world of Dr. Maturin. "Oh, indeed!" cried the Admiral, deeply impressed. "I shall have to take care of him, I find. Not that these clever politicos can really be trusted, you know. You must take a long spoon to sup with the devil, I always say. However, let's get to our lobsters. You can trust my lobsters, Orby. I sent a couple of boats to the westward for them the moment you made your number." The lobsters were trustworthy. So were the oysters. So was the rest of the enormous meal, which carried on remove after remove until the cloth was drawn at last and the port appeared, when Admiral Bertie called out, "Fill up, gentlemen, bumpers all round. Here's to Lucky Jack Aubrey with 3 times 3, and may he thump 'em again and again." A week later, the Governor of the Cape also honoured the Commodore with a feast. It consisted of game: Blaubok, Springbok, Steinbok, Klipspringer, Hartebeest, Wildebeest, the Black and the Blue. No lobster at all, and it took even longer to eat. But this was as far as the Governor's originality could take him. Once more the meal ended with cabinet pudding, and once more the guests drank their port, wishing that Jack might thump them again and again. At the time of this second toast, Stephen was eating bread and cold meat with Mr. Farquhar and Mr. Proat, his secretary, in an upper room of the government printing house, a secluded place from which the workmen had withdrawn. They were all of them more or less black, for in the light of Stephen's most recent intelligence, they'd been recasting a proclamation to the people of La Réunion, as well as a number of handbills and broadsheets that painted, in glowing colours and fluent French, the advantages of British rule, promising respect for religion, laws, customs and property, pointing out the inevitably disastrous consequences of resistance, and the rewards, perhaps a little imprecise and rhetorical, of cooperation. There were similar documents, though in a less forward state of preparation, addressed to the inhabitants of Mauritius. And all these were to be printed as secretly as possible with the help of 2 confidential journeymen. Yet since neither of these knew a word in French, Farquhar and Proat had been perpetually in and out of the house, and both had grown fascinated by the technical processes of printing. In their eagerness to show Stephen their proficiency, they corrected 3 long texts in the galley, reading by means of a little looking-glass that they tended to snatch from one another, plucking out letters, inserting others, prating about uppercase, lowercase, forms, coins and composing sticks, setting rules and justification, and gradually smearing themselves and him with an unreasonable quantity of printer's ink. They were no longer talking about the act of printing, however, not even about their insidious printed warfare. That, together with Stephen's detailed report of the promising state of public feeling on La Réunion and his account of the agents he had acquired, was far behind them. And now, as they ate their blotted meat, they discussed the poetry of the law. Or rather, poetry in the law, a subject to which they'd been led by considerations on the inheritance of landed property in Mr. Farquhar's future kingdom. The French system. Their new French code is very well on paper, observed Farquhar, very well for a parcel of logical automata, but it quite overlooks the illogical, I might say almost supra-logical, and poetic side of human nature. Our law, in its wisdom, has preserved much of this, and it's particularly remarkable in the customary tenure of land and in petty sergeanty. Allow me to give you an example. In the manors of East and West Enbourne in Berkshire, A widow shall have her free bench, her sedes libera, or in barbarous law Latin, her francus bancus, in all her late husband's copyhold lands, dum sola et casta fuerit. But if she be detected in amorous conversation with a person of the opposite sex, if she grant the last favours, she loses all, unless she appears in the next manor court riding backwards on a black ram and reciting the following words: Here I am, riding on a black ram like a whore as I am, and for my crinkum crankum have lost my binkum bankum, and for my tail's game am brought to this worldly shame. Therefore, good Mr. Steward, let me have my lands again. My uncle owns one of these manors, and I've attended the court. I cannot adequately describe the merriment, the amiable confusion of the personable young widow, the flood of rustic wit, and, which is my real point, the universal contented acceptance of her reinstatement, which I attribute largely to the power of poetry. There may be a significant statistical relationship between the number of black ram lambs suffered to reach maturity, said Prout, and that of personable young widows. And 'tis no isolated case, continued Farquhar, for in the manor of Kilmersdon, in Somerset, for example, we find what is essentially the same purgation, though in an abbreviated form, since no more than this distich is required. For mine arse's fault I take this pain, therefore, my lord, give me my land again. Now, is it not gratifying, gentlemen, to find our black rams, unprofitable creatures but for this interesting ceremony, so far apart as Berkshire and Somerset, with no record of a white ram's ever having been admitted? For your black ram, gentlemen, is, I'm persuaded, intimately connected with the worship of the Druids. Mr. Farquhar was a man with a good understanding and a great deal of information. But at the first mention of Druids, oak groves or mistletoe, a wild gleam came into his eye, a gleam so wild on this occasion that Stephen looked at his watch, rose to his feet, said that he must regretfully leave them, and gathered up his book. "Shouldn't you like to wash before you go?" asked Farquhar. "You're somewhat mottled." "Thank you," said Stephen, "but the being upon whom I am about to wait, though eminent for precedence, does not stand on ceremony." "What can he have meant by eminent for precedence?" asked Mr. Prout. "Anyone who is anyone, apart from us, is at the governor's." "He may well mean a black magus, or a potentate among the Hottentots. Now, the Druids, I say." In fact, the being's precedence was merely alphabetical, for in the gaiety of his heart, Dr. Maturin had referred to the aardvark. It stood before him now, a pale creature with a bulky, hog-backed body close on 5 feet long, a broad tail, an immense, elongated head ending in a disc-like snout, short, stout legs, and disproportionately long, translucent ass's ears. It was partially covered with sparse yellowish hair that showed the unwholesome night-walker's skin below. It blinked repeatedly. The aardvark was acutely conscious of its position, and from time to time it licked its small tubular lips. For not only had it been measured and weighed, while a tuft of bristles that could ill be spared had been clipped from its flank, but now it was being looked at through a diminishing glass and drawn. It was a meek, apologetic animal, incapable of biting and too shy to scratch, and it grew lower and lower in its spirits. Its ears drooped until they obscured its weak, melancholy, long-lashed eyes. "There, honey, it's done," said Stephen, showing the aardvark its likeness. And calling upwards through the ceiling, he said, "Mr. Van der Poel, I am infinitely obliged to you, so do not stir, I beg. I shall lock the door and leave the key under the mat. I'm going back to the ship, and tomorrow you shall see the egg." Some hours later, he beheld Simon's town again, its inner anchorage scattered with Jack's prizes. It reminded him of Port Mahon long ago, when the Sophies captured Felucca's Trabacolos and Zebex lined the quay. "That was very well," he said, "and Minorca a delightful island. But even Minorca could never boast the aardvark." The street was filled with Liberty men, a cheerful crew, for not only had Jack ordered a modest advance of prize money, $2 a nob paid down on the capstan head, but Dr. Maturin's words on loot hadn't been obeyed quite as strictly as he could have wished, and pieces of the finest oriental silk, slightly charred, covered the lithe forms, the infinitely seductive bosoms of the sailors' companions. He was hailed on all sides. Kind hands led his hired nag away, and a Boadicean midshipman, smelling strongly of patchouli, rowed him out to the Resonab. At ease in his spacious cabin, he opened his book and looked at the picture again. "It is, perhaps, the most gratifying beast I've ever figured," he said, "and it displays a touching affection for the good Mr. Van der Poel. I believe I shall attempt to colour it." He turned back through the pages. Most were covered with the small, close-written text of his diary, but there were several drawings, the Rodriguez tortoise, the seals of False Bay, some washed with watercolour. "Perhaps not," he said, considering them. "My talents scarcely seem to lie that way." He converted the Dutch weight of the aardvark into avoirdupois, sharpened his pen to a finer point, reflected for a while, gazing out of the scuttle, and began to write in his personal cipher. "I cannot trace the chain of thought, or rather of associations, that leads me to reflect upon Clonfert and Jack Aubrey. Conceivably the aardvark plays a part, so ill at ease, but the links are obscure. Clonfert's Taormina exercise my mind. For by whatever private scale of pain one may measure them, they must come tolerably high. It seems ludicrously facile to regard them as the direct transposition of his state of mind. Yet McAdam is no fool except to himself. And in some not dissimilar cases, the Dupuytren and I dissected, we were able to eliminate any direct physical cause. The vermiform appendix, so often the villain in these apparent strangulations, as pink as a healthy worm, the whole tract from the esophagus downwards devoid of lesion. Clonfert is more of an Irishman with the exacerbated susceptibilities of a subject race than I'd supposed. More, indeed, than I gave Jack to understand. I find that, as a boy, he did not attend a great English public school, as did most of his kind I've known, nor did he go early to sea and thereby wash away the barrier. The first years of his nominal service were book time, as they call the amiable cheat by which a complacent captain places an absent child upon his muster-roll. Far from it. He was brought up almost entirely by the servants at Jenkinsville, a desolate region. Squireen foster parents, too, for a while, his own being so mad or so disreputable. And he seems to have sucked in the worst of both sides. On the one hand, he derived his notion of himself as a lord from people who have had to cringe these many generations to hold on to the odd patch of land that is their only living. And, on the other, though half belonging to them, he has been bred up to despise their religion, their language, their poverty, their manners and traditions. A conquering race in the place of that conquest is rarely amiable. The conquerors pay less, obviously, than the conquered, but perhaps in time they pay even more heavily in the loss of the humane qualities. Hard, arrogant, profit-seeking adventurers flock to the spile. And the natives, though outwardly civil, contemplate them with a resentment mingled with contempt, while at the same time respecting the face of conquest, acknowledging their greater strength. And to be divided between the two must lead to a strange confusion of sentiment. In Clonfert's case, the result of this and of other factors seems to me an uneasy awareness of his own distinction. He often mentions it. A profound uncertainty of its real value, and a conviction that to validate its claims he should be twice as tall as other men. In spite of his high heels, both literal and figurative, he is not twice as tall as other men. Jack, in particular, tops him by a head and more. He has surrounded himself with a strikingly inferior set of officers, which I do not remember to have seen done in the Navy, where the aristocratic captains are almost always accompanied by aristocratic officers and midshipmen, just as a Scotch commander will gather Scotchmen around him. No doubt they provide him with the approval he longs for. But how much can a man of his understanding value their approval? And if Lady Clonfert and Mrs. Jennings are a fair example of his women, to what degree can their favours really gratify him? Upon this foundation, and upon what MacAdam tells me, I could build up a moderately convincing Clonfert whose entire life is an unsatisfactory pretence. A puppet, vainly striving to be another puppet equally unreal. The antithesis of Jack, who has never played a part in his life, who has no need for any role. It wouldn't satisfy me, however, for although it may have some truth in it, and although it may go far towards pointing at the origin of the Taormina and some other symptoms I have noted, MacAdam did not appreciate the significance of the asymmetric pseudo-insignis, it does not take into account the fact that he is not a puppet. Nor, which is far more important, does it take into account the affection of his men. Jack asserts that sailors love a lord, and no doubt that's profoundly true. Apart from anything else, the fancied difference diminishes the servitude. But they do not go on loving a lord if he's worthless. They did not go on loving Prince William. No. A continued affection over a long period must be based upon the recognition of real qualities in the man. For a ship at sea, particularly a small ship on a foreign station, is an enclosed village. And who ever heard of the long mature judgment of a village being wrong? The communal mind, even where the community is largely made up of unthinking and illiterate men, is very nearly as infallible as a council. And the qualities valued by a community of men are commonly good nature, generosity, and courage. Courage. Here I am on the most shifting ground in the world, for what is it? Men put different values on their lives at different times. Different men value approval at different rates. For some it is the prime mover. Two men go through the same motions for widely different reasons. Their conduct bears the same name. Yet if Clonfert has not performed these actions, I'm very sure that his men wouldn't esteem him as they do. Farquhar's illogicality may well render their affection for Lord Clonfert greater than it would be for Mr. Scroggs, but that is merely an addition. The esteem is already there, and so are the actions upon which it is founded. I saw him storm a battery at St. Paul's, and in the result his outward gestures, his élan, And, indeed, his success were indistinguishable from Jack Aubrey's. Jack Aubrey. The lieutenant of long ago is still visible in the grave Commodore, but there are times when he has to be looked for. One constant is that indubitable happy courage, the courage of the fabled lion. How I wish I may see a lion! Which makes him go into action as some men might go to their marriage bed. Every man would be a coward if he durst. It's true of most, I do believe, certainly of me, probably of Clonfert, but not of Jack Aubrey. Marriage has changed him, except in this. He'd hoped for too much, poor sanguine creature. Though, indeed, he is sick for news from home. And the weight of this new responsibility. He feels it extremely. Responsibility and the years. His youth is going, or indeed is gone. The change is evident, but it's difficult to name many particular alterations, apart from the comparative want of gaiety, of that appetence for mirth, of those infinitesimal jests that caused him at least such enormous merriment. I might mention his attitude towards those under his command, apart from those he's known for years. It is attentive, conscientious, and informed, but is far less personal. His mind, rather than his heart, is concerned, and the people are primarily instruments of war. And his attitude toward the ship itself? Well do I remember his boundless delight in his first command, although the Sophie was a sad, shabby little tub of a thing. The way he couldn't see enough of her meagre charms, bounding about the masts, the rigging, and the inner parts with an indefatigable zeal like a great boy. Now he's the captain of a lordly two-decker, with these vast rooms and balconies, and he's little more than polite to her. She might be one set of furnished lodgings rather than another. Though here I may be mistaken, some aspects of the sailor's life I do not understand. Then again, there is the diminution not only of his animal spirits, but also of his appetites. I'm no friend to adultery, which surely promises more than it can perform, except in the article of destruction, but I could wish that Jack had at least some temptation to withstand. His more fiery emotions, except where war is concerned, have cooled. Clonfert, younger in this, as in many other ways, has retained his capacity for the extremes of feeling, certainly the extremity of pain, perhaps that of delight. The loss is a natural process, no doubt, and one that prevents a man from burning away altogether before his time, but I should be sorry if, in Jack Aubrey's case, it were to proceed so far as a general cool indifference. For then the man I have known and valued so long would be no more than the walking corpse of himself. The sound of the boatswain's call, the clash of the marines presenting arms, told him that Jack Aubrey's body, quick or dead, was at this moment walking about within a few yards of him. Stephen dusted sand upon his book, closed it, and waited for the door to open. The officer who appeared did indeed resemble Commodore rather than Lieutenant Aubrey, even after he'd flung his coat and withered the marks of rank onto a nearby locker. He was bloated with food and wine, his eyes were red and there were liverish circles under them, and he was obviously far too hot. But as well as the jaded look of a man who's been obliged to eat and drink far too much and then sit in an open carriage for 20 miles in a torrid dust storm, wearing clothes calculated for the English Channel, his face had an expression of discouragement. "Oh, for some more soldiers like Keating," he said wearily. "I can't get them to move." We had a council after dinner, and I represented to them that with the regiments under their command we could take La Réunion out of hand. The Raisonnable would serve as a troop carrier, St. Paul's is wide open, with not one stone of the batteries standing on another. They agreed and groaned and lamented. They couldn't move without an order from the Horse Guards. It's always been understood that the necessary forces were to come from the Madras establishment, perhaps with the next monsoon if transports could be found, if not with the monsoon after that. By the next monsoon, said I, La Réunion would be bristling with guns, whereas now the French had very few, and those few served by men with no appetite for a battle of any kind. By the next monsoon their spirits would have revived, and they would have been reinforced from the Mauritius. Very true, said the soldiers, wagging their heads, but they feared that the plan worked out by the staff must stand. Should I like to go shooting warthogs with them on Saturday? And to crown all, the brig was not a packet, but a merchantman from the Azores. No letters of any kind. We might as well be at the back of the moon.
It is very trying indeed, said Stephen. What say you to some barley water with lime juice in it, and then a swim? We could take a boat to the island where the seals live.
To a cooler, fresher Jack, he offered what comfort he could provide. He left the stolid torpor of the soldiers to one side. Neither had really believed in the possibility of stirring them after the dismal end of the unauthorized expedition to Buenos Aires from this very station not many years before, and concentrated on the changed perception of time during periods of activity. These busy weeks had assumed an importance unjustified by their sidereal, or, as he might say, their absolute measure. With regard to exterior events, they still remained mere weeks. It had been unreasonable to expect anything on their return to the Cape. But now a ship might come in any day at all, loaded with mail. I hope you're right, Stephen, said Jack, balancing on the gunwale and rubbing the long blue wound on his back. Sophie's been very much in my mind these last few days, and even the children. I dreamt of her last night, a huddled, uneasy dream, and I longed to hear from her. After a considering pause, he said, I did bring back some more pleasant news, however. The Admiral's fairly confident of being able to add Iphigenia and Magicienne to the squadron within the next few weeks. He had word from Sumatra. But, of course, they'll be coming from the east. Not the least possibility of anything from home. The old Leopard, too, though nobody wants her. Iron sick throughout, a real graveyard ship. The packet will come in from one day to the next, and it will bring a budget of tax demands, bills, and an account of the usual domestic catastrophes. News of mumps, chicken pox, a leaking tap. My prophetic soul sees it beneath the horizon. The days dropped by while the Boadicea, her holds emptied and herself heaved down with perches to bollards on the shore, had her foul bottom cleaned. Jack set up his telescope with a new counterbalance that worked perfectly on land. Stephen saw his lion, a pride of lions. And then, although it had mistaken the horizon, his prophetic soul was shown to have been right. News did come in. But it was not domestic news, nor from the west. The Flying Wasp had turned about in mid-ocean and had come racing back to the Cape to report that the French had taken three more Indiamen, HM Sloop Victor and the powerful Portuguese frigate Minerva. The Venus and the Manche, already at sea when the squadron looked into Port Louis, had captured the Windham, the United Kingdom and the Charlton, all Indiamen of the highest value. The Bellone, slipping out past the blockade by night, had taken the 18-gun Victor, and then she and her prize had set about the Minerva, which mounted 52 guns, but which mounted them in vain against the fury of the French attack. The Portuguese, now La Minerve, was at present in Port Louis, manned by seamen from the Canonnière and some deserters. The Indiaman, The Venus and the Marsh were probably there too, but of that the Wasp was not quite sure. Before the turn of the tide, Jack was at sea. The warthogs, the soldiers, and even his telescope left behind. He'd shifted his pendant into the Boadicea, for the hurricane months were not far away, and the Razor Knob couldn't face them. He was back in his own Boadicea, driving her through variable and sometimes contrary winds until they reached the steady southeast trade, where she lay over with her lee rail under white water, her decks sloping like the roof of Ashgrove Cottage, and began to tear off her 250 and even 300 nautical miles between one noon observation and the next. For there was some remote hope of catching the Frenchmen and their prizes, cutting them off before they reached Mauritius. On the second Sunday after their departure, with church rigged, Jack was reading the Articles of War in a loud, official, commentary voice, by way of sermon, and all hands were trying to keep upright, for not a sail might be attempted to be touched. He'd just reached Article 29, which dealt with sodomy by hanging the sodomite, and which always made Spotted Dick and other midshipmen swell purple from suppressed giggling at every monthly repetition, when two ships heaved in sight. They were a great way off, and without interrupting her devotions, such as they might be with every mind fixed earnestly upon the masthead, the Boadicea edged away to gain the weather gauge. But by the time Jack had reached All Crimes Not Capital, there were precious few, and well before he cleared the ship for action, the Windward Stranger broke out the private signal. In answer to the Boadicea, she made her number. The Magicienne and her companion was the Windham. The Magicienne, said Captain Curtis, coming aboard the Commodore, had retaken the Indiaman off the east coast of Mauritius. The Windham had been separated from her captor, the Venus, during a tremendous sudden blow in 17 degrees south. The Magicienne had snapped her up after something of a chase, beating to windward all day, and had then stood on all night in the hope of finding the French frigate. Curtis had found her at sunset, looking like a scarecrow with only her lower mast standing and a few scraps of canvas aboard, far away right under the land, creeping in with her tattered forecourse alone. But unhappily the land to which she was creeping was the entrance to Grand Port, and when the land breeze set in, blowing straight in her teeth, the Magicienne had the mortification of seeing the Venus towed right under the guns of the Ile de la Passe at the entrance to the haven. "By the next morning, sir, when I could stand in," said Curtis apologetically, "she was halfway up to the far end, and with my ammunition so low, only 11 rounds to a gun, and the Indiaman in such a state, I didn't think it right to follow her." "Certainly not," said Jack, thinking of that long inlet guarded by the strongly fortified Ile de la Passe, by batteries on either side and at the bottom, and even more by a tricky, winding fairway fringed with reefs. The Navy called it Port Southeast, as opposed to Port Louis in the northwest, and he knew it well. "Certainly not. It would have meant throwing the Magicienne away. And I need her. Oh, yes, indeed I need her, now they have that thumping great Minerva. You'll dine with me, Curtis? Then we must bear away for poor Louis." They passed the Indiaman a tow, and lugging their heavy burden through the sea, they stood on, the wind just abaft the beam. Stephen Maturin had been deeply mistaken in supposing that Jack, older and more consequential, now looked upon ships as lodgings more or less comfortable. The Razor Knob had never been truly his. He wasn't wedded to her. The Boadicea was essentially different. He entered into her. He was one of her people. He knew them all, and with a few exceptions, he liked them all. He was delighted to be back.
And although Captain Elliot had been a perfectly unexceptionable officer, they were delighted to have him. They had, in fact, led Elliot a sad life of it, opposing an elastic but effective resistance to the slightest hint of change. The Commodore had always liked it this way. The Commodore had always liked it that. It was Captain Aubrey that had personally ordered the brass bow chasers to be painted brown. Jack particularly valued Mr. Fellows, his boatswain, who had clung even more firmly than most to Captain Aubrey's sail plan, and his huge, ugly snatch blocks that allowed hawsers to be instantly set up to the mastheads, there to withstand the strain of an extraordinary spread of canvas. And now that the Boadicea's hold had been thoroughly re-stowed, her hull careened and her standing rigging re-rove with the spoils of St. Paul's, she answered their joint hopes entirely. In spite of her heavy burden, she was now making 9 knots at every heave of the log. "She's making a steady 9 knots," said Jack, coming below after quarters. "How happy you make me, Jack," said Stephen. "And you might make me even happier, should you so wish, by giving me a hand with this. The unreasonable attitude or lurch of the ship caused me to overset the chest." "God help us!" cried Jack, gazing at the mass of gold coins lying in a deep curve along the leeward side of the cabin. "What's this?" "It is technically known as money," said Stephen, "and was you to help me pick it up instead of leering upon it with a stunned concupiscence more worthy of Danny than a king's officer, we might conceivably save some few pieces before they all slip through the cracks in the floor. Come, come, bear a hand there." They picked and shovelled busily on all fours, and when the thick, squat, iron-bound box was full again, Stephen said, "They are to go into these small little bags, if you please, by fifties, each to be tied with string. Will I tell you what it is, Jack?" he said as the heavy bags piled up. "If you please. It is the vile, corrupting British gold that Bonaparte and his newspapers do so perpetually call out against. Sometimes it exists, as you perceive. And, I might tell you, every louis, every napoleon, every ducat or doubloon is sound. The French sometimes buy services or intelligence with false coin or paper. That's the kind of thing that gives espionage a bad name. If we pay real money, it's to be presumed we get better intelligence," said Jack. "Well, truly, it's much of a muchness. Your paid agent and his information are rarely of much consequence. The real jewel, unpurchasable beyond all price, is the man who hates tyranny as bitterly as I do. In this case, the royalist or the true republican who will risk his life to bring down that Bonaparte. There are several of them on La Réunion, and I have every reason to believe there are more on the Mauritius. As for your common venal agents," said Stephen, shrugging, "most of these bags are for them. It may do some good. Indeed, it probably will, men rarely being all of a piece. Tell me, when shall you be able to set me down? And how do you reckon the odds at present?" "As to the first," said Jack, "I can't say until I've looked into poor Louis. The odds? I believe they're still about evens for the moment. If they've gained the Minerva, we've gained the Magicienne. You'll tell me that the Minerva is the heaviest of the two, and that the Magicienne only carries 12 pounders. But Lucius Curtis is a rare plucked and a damn good seaman. So let's say evens for the moment. For the moment, I say, because the hurricane season is coming, and if they lie snug in port and we outside, why, there's no telling how we shall stand in a few weeks' time." During the night they brought the wind aft as they went north about Mauritius, and when Stephen woke he found the Boadicea on an even keel. She was pitching gently, and the urgent music that had filled her between decks these last days was no longer to be heard. He washed his face perfunctorily, passed his hand over his beard, said, "It'll do for today," and hurried into the day cabin, eager for coffee and his first little paper cigar of the day. Killick was there, gaping out of the stern window, with the coffee pot in his hand. "Good morning, Killick," said Stephen. "Where's himself?" "Good morning, sir," said Killick, "which is still on deck." "Killick," said Stephen, "what's amiss? Have you seen the ghost in the bread room? Are you sick? Show me your tongue." When Killick had withdrawn his tongue, a flannelly object of inordinate length, he said, paler still, "Is there a ghost in the bread room, sir?" "Oh, and I was there in the middle watch. Oh, sir, I might have seen it." "There is always a ghost in the bread room. Light along that pot, will you, now?" "I dursn't," said, "begging your pardon. There's worse news than the ghost, even. Them wicked old rats got at the coffee, sir. I doubt there's another pot in the barkey." "Preserved, Killick, pass me that pot, or you will join the ghost in the bread room and howl for evermore." With extreme unwillingness, Killick put the pot on the very edge of the table, muttering, "Oh, I'll cop it. Oh, I'll cop it." Jack walked in, poured himself a cup as he bade Stephen good morning, and said, "I'm afraid they're all in."
"All in what?"
"All the Frenchmen are in harbour with their two Indiamen and the Victor." "Haven't you been on deck?" "We're lying off Port Louis. The coffee's damned odd taste." "They say a tribute to the excrement of rats. Rats have eaten our entire stock, and I take the present brew to be a mixture of the scrapings at the bottom of the sack." "I thought it had a familiar tang," said Jack. "Killick, you may tell Mr. Seymour with my compliments that you are to have a boat. And if you don't find at least a stone of beans among the squadron, you needn't come back. It's no use trying Nereid, she don't drink any." When the pot had been jealously divided down to its ultimate dregs, dregs that might have been called dubious had there been the least doubt of their nature, they went on deck. The Boadicea was lying in a splendid bay with the rest of the squadron ahead and astern of her. Sirius, Nereid, Otter, the brig Grappler, which they had retaken at St. Paul's, and a couple of fore-and-aft rigged divisors from the same source. To leeward, the Windham Indiaman, with parties from each ship repairing the damage caused by the blow and the violence of the enemy, watched by the philosophical French prize crew. At the bottom of the deep curve lay Port Louis, the capital of Mauritius, with green hills rising behind and cloud-capped mountains beyond them. "Shall you adventure to the main top?" asked Jack. "I could show you better from up there."
"Certainly," said Stephen. "To the ultimate cross-trees, if you choose. I, too, am nimble as an ape."
Jack was moved to ask whether there were earthbound apes, as compact as lead, afflicted with vertigo, possessed of two left hands and no sense of balance. But he'd seen the startling effect of a challenge upon his friend, and apart from grunting as he thrust Stephen up through the lubber's hole, he remained silent until they were comfortably installed among the stunsels, with their glasses trained upon the town. "You have the white building with the tricolour flying over it," said Jack. "That is General de Caen's headquarters. Now, come down to the shore and a little to the right, and there is the Bellone. She's swaying up a new foretop mast. Another foot." He holds up his hand. He bangs home the fid. Neatly done, most seamanlike. Inside her lies the Victor. Do you see the French colours over ours? The dogs. Though indeed she was theirs before she was ours. Inside again, the French colours over the Portuguese. That's the Minerva. A very heavy frigate, Stephen. and no sign of her having been roughly handled that I can see. Then comes the Venus, with the broad pendant alongside the sheer hulk. They're giving her a new mizzen. Now, she has been handled rough. Bowsprit done in the gammoning, head rails all ahoo, not a dead eye left this side hardly, and very low in the water, pumps hard at it. I wonder they managed to bring her in. Yet it was early in the year for that kind of blow. She must have been in the heart of it, the Indiaman on the edge and the magician quite outside, for Curtis never even struck his t'gallant masts.
Your hurricane has a rotatory motion, I believe.
Exactly so. And you can be taken aback just when you think you've rode it out. Then, over to the right, you have the Manche and a corvette. The Creole, I believe. A very tidy squadron once they've put the Venus to rights. What a match it would be, was they to come out and fight their ships as well as that gallant fellow at St. Paul's fought his. What was his name?
Ferretier. Do you suppose they mean to come out?
Never in life, said Jack. Not unless I can amuse them. Not unless I can make their Commodore believe we're no longer in the offing, or only one or two of us. Now it looks like Brest or Toulon all over again. Steady blockade until we're down to Salt Horse and Old Weevil's wedding cake. We used to call it polishing Cape Sissier in the Mediterranean, but at least it means that I can send you down to La Réunion with the grappler if you really have to go. She can convoy the Wyndham that far in case of the odd privateer and be back the next day. It's barely 30 leagues, and with this steady wind... Forgive me, Stephen, it's time for my captains. There's Clonfert's gig putting off already with his damn fool boat's crew. Why does he have to make such a rary show of himself? Other captains dress their boat's crew in odd garments. Still, there is such a thing as measure. I don't look forward to this meeting, Stephen. I shall have to call for an explanation. They'll have to tell me how the Bellone got out. However, it'll not be long. Shall you wait for me here? The conference was longer than Jack had expected, but Stephen, cradled in his top as it swung fore and aft on the long, even swell, scarcely noticed the passage of time. He was warm through and through, so warm that he took off his neckcloth, and while his eye dwelt on the motions of the seabirds, noddies for the most part, the routine work on the deck below, the repairs carrying on aboard the Wyndham, and the boats moving to and fro, his mind was far away on La Réunion. Following a large number of schemes designed to overcome the French reluctance to becoming British by means less forthright and less murderous than a yardarm to yardarm engagement with both broadsides roaring loud, he was, therefore, almost surprised to see the Commodore's large red face heave up over the edge of his capacious nest, while at the same time he was concerned to see its heavy, anxious expression, the comparative dullness of that bright blue eye. "This is a damned awkward harbour for a close blockade," observed the Commodore. "Easy enough to slip out of with the wind almost always in the southeast, but difficult to enter without you're lucky with the sea breeze and the tide. That's why they use St. Paul's so often. And difficult to bottle up tight in the dark of the moon. Still, come down into the cabin if you'd like a wet. Killick discovered a few pale ancient beans that will just provide our elevenses." In the cabin he said, "I don't blame them for letting the Bellone slip between them and the Cape. And the cannoneer was gone before ever they reached their stations. But I do blame them for falling out over it. There they sat like a couple of cross dogs, answering short and glaring at one another. It was Pym's responsibility as the senior captain, of course. But whose fault it was, in fact, I couldn't make out. All I'm sure of is that they're on wretched terms. Clonfert seems to have a genius that way, but I'm surprised at Pym. Such an easy, good-natured fellow. However, I've invited all captains to dine, and let's hope that'll smooth things over. It's a miserable business, these rivalries in a squadron. I thought I'd got rid of them with Corbett. Although this dinner, whose main dishes were a 400-pound turtle and a saddle of mutton from the Cape, was eaten in a humid 90 degrees, it did restore a semblance of civility, if not more. Pym was no man to keep up a resentment, and Clomfort could command the social graces. They drank wine together, and Jack saw with relief that his entertainment was going fairly well. Curtis of the Magicienne was a lively, conversable man, and had much to tell them about the French squadron and its depredations in the company's far eastern settlements. Amelin, their commodore, was a savage Jacobin fellow, it seemed, though a good seaman, while Duperré of the Bellone had a fine, swift sailing ship, and he fought her with great determination. And the French crews were in a surprisingly high state of efficiency. Curtis's account carried the dinner over the first formal stage, and soon there was plenty of animated talk. Although, indeed, Clomfort addressed almost all his conversation to his neighbour, Dr. Maturin, and the two young commanders, Tomkinson of the Otter and Dent of the Grappler, didn't feel it proper to open their mouths except to admit Calipash and Calipee, Fat Tail Sheep and Cape Madeira. "You and Clomfort got along very well together," observed Jack when his bloated guests had gone. "What did you find to talk about? Is he a reading man?"
"He reads novels. But most of the time we spoke of his exploration of these coasts. He has charted many of the inlets, rowing in with his black pilot, and he has a surprising fund of information."
"Yes, I know. He outdoes Corbett in that, I believe. He has real abilities, if only..." "What now?"
"All ready, sir," said Bondon. "Show me the pockets." "Number 7 canvasser, double sewn," said Bondon, spreading his jacket and displaying an array of pouches. "With flaps."
"Very good. Now stow these away and button them up tight." As he received the little heavy bags, Bondon's visage took on a glassy, know-nothing look. He said no word. He extinguished the gleam of intelligence in his eye. "There we are," said Jack. "And here is a chit for Captain Dent. He'll ask you if you can make out the leading marks for the cove where Wasp put the doctor ashore. And if you cannot, mark me, Bondon, if you're not dead certain of both marks and soundings, you're to say so whether they think you a Jack Puddin' or no. And, Bondon, you take great care of the doctor. Hammer his pistol flints, do you hear me? And don't let him get his feet wet."
"Aye, aye, sir," said Bondon.
A few minutes later, the boat pulled away. Bondon, though unnaturally stout in his close-buttoned jacket, sprang up the side of the grappler and hauled Stephen aboard, and the brig headed southwest, followed by the Indiaman. Jack watched them until they were hull down, and then he turned his gaze to the shore with its fortifications sharp and clear against the bright green of sugar-cane. He could almost feel the answering gaze of the French commanders training their telescopes on the squadron, particularly that of Amelin, his equivalent on the other side. And as he gave the orders that would set the long blockade in motion, he turned over the possibilities of amusing them and of bringing them out to fight. He'd tried several before the grappler came back, bearing Stephen, loaded with intelligence, a chest of the best coffee in the world, and a new machine for roasting it. He had tried open provocation and lame duck ruses, but Amelin wouldn't bite the cunning dog. The French lay there at their ease, and the squadron was obliged to be content with its steady routine of beating to and fro, with only the prospect of Christmas to encourage them. By no means all the news that Stephen brought was good. The frigate Astrée was expected from France. The disaffection of the commandant of St. Paul's had much diminished since General de Brulé's death, and an important body of regulars with fervently Bonapartist officers had arrived. La Réunion would be much harder to take with the promised 3,000 troops from India than it would have been with half that number from the Cape some weeks earlier. In the opinion of the French officers, it couldn't be successfully attacked, even with good weather for landing, by less than 5,000 men. On the other hand, he'd learnt a great deal about Mauritius, the more important island of the two by far, with its splendid ports. Among other things, a considerable part of the French garrison was made up of Irish troops, prisoners of war or volunteers who still believed in Bonaparte. And Stephen had many contacts to make, some that might be of the greatest value. "So," said he, "as soon as you can let me have the Nereide with Clomfert's local knowledge and his black pilot, I should like to begin the work of preparation. Apart from other considerations, our broadsheets need time to have their effect, and some well-chosen rumour, some indiscretion in the proper place, might conceivably bring your French frigates out." Jack freely admitted the importance of the task in hand. "Yet do you think me weak, Stephen, when I say how I regret the days when we were of no account? When we cruised by ourselves, pretty busy at times, but often free for our hand of piquet in the evening and our music. You shall have Nereide tomorrow, if you choose, since Venus has chosen this moment to heave down, and the Manche shows signs of doing much the same, so I can spare a ship. But at least let's have this evening to ourselves. While you were away, I transposed the Corelli for violin and cello." The music tied them back to what seemed a very distant past, one in which no Commodore's secretary with his heap of papers had to be kept away for a few hours' peace, a past where no susceptible captains had to have their feelings managed, and where what little administration the first lieutenant left to his captain could be settled out of hand among people he knew intimately well. But the morning brought Mr. Peter back with a score of documents. The magicienne was very much afraid that she would have to ask for a court-martial upon her yeoman of the sheets for an almost unbelievable series of offences, starting with drunkenness and ending with a marlin spike struck into the ship's corporal's belly. And the Sirius was running short of wood and water. Stephen crossed to the Nereide after no more than the briefest farewell. He found Clomfert in high spirits, delighted to be away on his own, delighted to be away from the Commodore's rigid discipline. For although there were many things in which Jack and Lord St. Vincent didn't see eye to eye, including politics and free speech, they were at one in their notions on keeping station and on prompt, exact obedience to signals. They walked the quarter-deck in the forenoon, and as they strolled up and down the windward side, with the high wooded shore of Mauritius gliding by and shimmering in the heat, Stephen took in the atmosphere of the ship. There were few original Nereides left, since Clonfert had brought all his officers together with most of the Otter's crew, and there was the same feeling in the frigate as there had been in the sloop. In many ways it was much like that in any man-of-war, that is to say, the hands' activities, the employment of their strictly regulated time, the almost fanatical regard to neatness, were much the same as he had observed in other ships. Yet in none of Jack Aubrey's commands had he ever heard the captain's orders followed by suggestions that things might be better otherwise. And this, as it were, consultation appeared to be customary right down the hierarchy, from the officer of the watch to Jemmy Ducks who looked after the poultry.
With his limited experience, Stephen couldn't say that it was wrong. Everybody seemed brisk and cheerful, and when a manoeuvre was decided upon, it was carried out promptly. But he had supposed this loquacity and tergiversation to be confined to the navy of the French, that lively, articulate nation. The exception seemed to be the warrant officers, the master, the boatswain, the gunner and the carpenter, grave men who adhered to the Royal Navy's tradition as Stephen had seen it, particularly the magnificent, granite-faced Mr. Satterley, the elderly master, who appeared to regard his captain with a veiled, affectionate indulgence and to run the ship with scarcely a word. The commissioned officers and the young gentlemen were far less mute. They obviously desired Clonfert's favour and attention, and they competed for it partly by activity and partly by a curious mixture of freedom and something not far from servility. The words "My Lord" were always in their mouths, and they pulled off their hats with a marked deference whenever they addressed him. Yet they addressed him far more often than was usual in any ship that Stephen had known, crossing to his side of the quarter-deck unasked and volunteering remarks of no great consequence, unconnected with their duty. Perhaps high spirits didn't suit Clonfert quite so well as low. When he led Stephen to his cabin, he showed its furnishings with a somewhat tiresome exultation, though he'd insisting that this arrangement was merely temporary. Not quite the thing for a post-captain, passable in a sloop, but a trifle shabby in a frigate. The cabin, like most of those in rated ships, was a strikingly beautiful room. In Corbett's time it had been bare, scrubbed wood, gleaming brass, shining windows, and little more. Now that Spartan interior, rather too large for Clonfert's possessions, looked as though a brothel had moved into a monastery and as though it had not yet settled down. The size of the room was increased by two large pier glasses that Clonfert had brought with him from the Otter, one to port, the other to starboard. He strode to and fro between them, telling Stephen the history of the hanging lamp in some detail. And Stephen, sitting cross-legged upon the sofa, noticed that at each turn Clonfert automatically glanced at his reflection with a look of inquiry, doubt, and complacence. During dinner the captain ran on about his Turkish and Syrian experiences with Sir Sidney Smith, and at some point Stephen became aware that for Clonfert he had ceased to be a table companion and had turned into an audience. It was quite unlike their friendly discourse of some days before, and presently Stephen grew sadly bored. Lies, or half-lies, he reflected, had a certain value in that they gave a picture of what the man would wish to seem, but a very few were enough for that. And then they had a striving, aggressive quality, as though the listener had to be bludgeoned into admiration. They were the antithesis of conversation. They can also be embarrassing, he thought, looking down at his plate, for Clonfert was now astride that unfortunate unicorn. It was a handsome plate, with the Scrog's crest engraved broad and fair upon the rim, but it was a Sheffield plate, and the copper was showing through. Embarrassing and hard work, since in common humanity one must keep the man in countenance. What a state of nervous excitement he is in, to be sure. Yet although Stephen kept Clonfert decently in countenance, mutely acquiescing in the unicorn and a variety of unlikely feats, he didn't put such violence upon himself as to encourage a very long continuation.
Eventually, Clonfert grew conscious that he had somehow missed the tone, that his audience was not impressed, was not with him, and an anxious look came into his eye. He laid himself out to be more agreeable, speaking once again of his gratitude for Stephen's care of him during his seizure. "It's a wretched, unmanly kind of disease," he said. "I've begged McAdam to use the knife, if it would do any good, but he seems to think it nervous, something like a fit of the mother. I don't suppose the Commodore ever suffers from anything of that kind."
"If he did, I should certainly not speak of his disorder, nor the disorder of any other patient under my hands," said Stephen. "But," he added more kindly, "you are not to suppose that there is anything in the least discreditable in your malady. The degree of pain exceeds anything I have seen in any Taormina, whatever their origin." Clonfert looked pleased, and Stephen went on. "It is a grave matter indeed, and you are fortunate in having such an adviser as Dr. McAdam in daily reach. I believe, with your leave, that I shall wait upon him presently."
"Honest McAdam, yes," said Clonfert with a return to his former manner. "Yes, he may be no Solomon, and we must overlook certain frailties and an unfortunate manner, but I believe he's sincerely devoted to me. He was somewhat indisposed this morning, or he would have paid his respects when you came aboard, but I believe he's up and about by now." McAdam was in his sick bay, looking frail. Fortunately for the Nereids, his mate, Mr. Fenton, was a sound, practical ship's surgeon, for McAdam had little interest in physical medicine. He showed Stephen his few cases, and they lingered a while over a seaman whose inoperable gamata were pressing on his brain in such a manner that his speech followed an inverted logic of its own. "The sequence is not without its value," said McAdam, "though it's scarcely in my line. For that matter, there's little scope for my studies in a ship of war. Come away below, and we'll take a drop." Far below, in the smell of bilge water and grog, he went on, "Mighty little scope. The lower deck is kept far too busy for much to develop apart from the common perversions. Not that I would have you understand that I agree for a moment with the wicked old bedlam chains and straw and cold water and whipping. But there may be some fancies that in the egg cannot stand a wee starting with a rope's end, nor close company. At any rate, I've not had a decent melancholia from the lower deck this commission. Manias, yes, but they're two a penny. No, it's aft that you must look for your fine flower of derangement. Not forgetting the pursers and clerks and schoolmasters, all mewed up more or less alone. But above all, your captains. That's where the really interesting cases lie. How did you find our patient?"
"In a high flow of spirits. The hellebore answers, I believe."
For some time they discussed valerian, polypody of the oak, and stinking gladwin, their effects, and Stephen recommended the moderate use of coffee and tobacco. Then McAdam branched off to ask, "And did he speak of Captain Aubrey at all?"
"Barely. In the circumstances, it was an omission that I found remarkable."
"Hey! And significant too, colleague, most significant. He's been on about Captain Aubrey these last days, and I took particular notice of the pseudor in sickness that you pointed out. It coincides within an hour or so. He was obliged to shift his coat after every bout. He is a chestful, and the right side of each one is pale from scrubbing away the salt, the right side alone."
"It would be interesting to analyse that salt. Belladonna would suppress the sweat, of course. No more grog, I thank you. But it appears to me that for our patient, truth is what he can persuade others to believe.
yet at the same time he's a man of some parts, and I suspect that were you to attack him through his reason, were you to persuade him to abandon this self-defeating practice with its anxiety, its probability of detection, and to seek only a more legitimate approval, then we should have no need for belladonna or any other anhydrotic. You're coming into my way of thinking, I find. But you're not come far enough. The trouble lies much deeper. And it's through unreason that the whole nexus must be attacked. Your belladonna and your logic are pills in the same box. They only suppress the symptom. How do you propose to attain this end? Listen now, will you? Cried McAdam, slopping out a full tumbler and drawing his chair so near that his breath wafted in Stephen's face, and I'll tell you. In his diary that night, Stephen wrote, if he could carry out a reconstruction of the Irish political and social history for the last few ages which has formed our patient, and then a similar rebuilding of his mind from its foundation in early childhood to the present day, McAdam's scheme would be admirable. Yet even for the second part, what tools does he dispose of? A pickaxe is all. A pickaxe to repair a chronometer. And a pickaxe in drunken hands at that. For my part, I have a higher opinion of Clomfort's understanding, if not of his judgment, than has my poor southern colleague. This higher opinion was confirmed the next evening, when the Nereid made her way through a wicked series of reefs off Cape Brabant, and the gig put Stephen and the captain ashore in a little creek. And the next, when the black pilot not only took them into a still lagoon, but also guided them through the forest to a village where Stephen had a conversation with a second potential ally. And again, some days later, during a stroll behind Port Southeast with a packet of subversive papers. As he told Jack on rejoining the Boadicea, Clonfert may not be his own best friend in some ways, but he's capable of a steadiness and a resolution that surprised me. And I must observe that he perpetually took notes of the depth of the water and of the bearings and what I'm persuaded you would call a seaman-like manner. So much the better, cried Jack. I'm delighted to hear it, upon my word and honour. I've been doing something in that line myself with young Richardson. He promises to be a capital hydrographer. We've laid down most of the nearby coast with double angles and any number of soundings, and I've discovered a watering place on Flat Island, a few leagues to the northwards, so we shall not have to be perpetually fagging out to Rodriguez. No, Rodriguez, said Stephen in a low voice. Oh, you shall see Rodriguez again, said Jack. We still have to put in there for stores, turn and turn about, but not quite so often. Turn and turn about they went, while the French remained obstinately at peace in their deep harbour, fitting themselves out anew to the last dump bolt. And turn by turn, when he was not away in the Nereid down the coast, Stephen moved into each departing ship. His limestone caves on Rodriguez fulfilled all their golden promise. Colonel Keating was kindness itself, providing fatigue parties and draining a small marsh. And by the third turn, Stephen was able to report that, from the bones found in the mud alone, he could almost promise Jack the sight of a complete skeleton of the solitaire within the next 2 months, while at the same time he might partially clothe it with feathers and pieces of skin found in the caves. For the rest of the time it was plain blockade. Inshore at night, off the capes by day, but never far lest a Frenchman should slip out on the land breeze
go north, about in the darkness, and bear away for the rich waters of the Indian Ocean, leaving the squadron a great way to leeward. Up and down, up and down. And all the time their thin canvas grew thinner in the tropical sun and the sudden prodigious downpours. Their running rigging, incessantly passing through the countless blocks as they trimmed sail, gradually wasted away in those wisps called shakings, and the weed accumulated on their bottoms, while through the gaps in their copper the teredos thrust their augers through the oak. Christmas, and an immense feast on the upper deck of the Boadicea, with a barrel of providently salted penguins from off the Cape serving as geese or turkeys, according to the taste and fancy of the mess, and plum duff, blazing faint blue under the awnings, spread against the fiercer blaze of the Mauritian sun. New Year, with a great deal of ship visiting. Twelfth Night, and the midshipman's berth regaled the gunroom with a 200-pound turtle. An unfortunate experiment, for it was the wrong kind of turtle. The shell turned into glue, and all who'd eaten of the creature pissed emerald green. And now Jack began to consult his barometer every watch. It was a handsome, heavily protected brass instrument, hanging in gimbals by the table on which they breakfasted, and he was unscrewing its bottom when Stephen observed, "I shall soon have to think of another trip to La Réunion. This Mauritius brew is sad stuff in comparison." "Very true," said Jack, "but drink it while you may. Carpe diem, Stephen, you may not get another cup. I unscrewed this shield because I thought the tube must have broke, but here's the quicksilver, do you see, lower than I've ever seen it in my life. You'd better stow your bones in the safest place you can think of. We're in for an uncommon hearty blow." Stephen swept the vertebra he'd been sorting into his napkin and followed Jack on deck. The sky was pure and innocent, the swell rather less than usual. On the starboard bow the familiar landscape lay broad and green under the eastern sun. "Magicien's at it already," said Jack, glancing at the busy hands over the water, setting up double preventer stays. "Nereid has been caught napping. Mr. Johnson, squadron, make sail. Course due west. Prepare for heavy weather." He turned his glass to poor Louis. Yes, there was no fear of the French slipping out. They too could read a barometer, and they too were making all fast. "Might this portend a hurricane?" asked Stephen privately in his ear. "Yes," said Jack, "and we must have all the sea room we can win. How I wish Madagascar were farther off." They won 40 miles of sea room. The boats on the booms could scarcely be seen for frappings. The guns were double-breached, bowsed up against the side until they made it groan. T'gallant masts were down on deck, storm canvas bent, spare gaskets, rolling tackles, spritsail yard fore and aft. All that a great deal of activity and experienced seamanship could accomplish was done, and all under the same pure sun. The swell increased long before a darkness gathered in the north. "Mr. Seymour," said Jack, "tarpaulins and battens for the hatchways. When it comes, it'll blow across the sea." It came. A curved white line racing across the sea with inconceivable rapidity, a mile in front of the darkness. Just before it reached them, the Boadicea's close-reefed topsails sagged, losing all their roundness. Then a tearing wall of air and water ripped them from their bolt tops with an enormous shrieking howl. The ship was on her beam ends, the darkness was upon them, and the known world dissolved in a vast, omnipresent noise. Air and water were intermingled. There was no surface to the sea. The sky vanished, and the distinction between up and down disappeared. Disappeared momentarily for those on deck, more durably for Dr. Maturin, who, having pitched down two ladders, found himself lying on the ship's side. Presently she righted, and he slid down. But on her taking a most furious lee lurch on wearing round, he shot across the deck through all his remaining stock of Venice treacle to land on hands and knees upon the other side, clinging to a suspended locker in the darkness, puzzled. In time, gravity reasserted itself. He climbed down, still mazed from the prodigious din and by his tumbles, and groped his way forward to the sick bay. Here, Carol, nominally his assistant, but in fact the virtual surgeon of the frigate, and the loblolly boy had preserved their lantern by whose light they were disentangling their only patient, a poxed member of the afterguard, whose hammock, twirling in the violent motion, had enveloped him like a cocoon. Here they remained, hooting lugubriously to one another for a while. Rank had little significance in this pandemonium, and the loblolly boy, an ancient man, once sailmaker's crew and still good at sewing, told them in his shrill, carrying voice that in Jamaica, as a boy, he had known seven ships of the line founder with all hands in a blow not half as huge as this here. Presently Stephen shouted, "Come after, Mr. Carroll, and let's take all the lanterns we can find. The casualties will soon be coming down." They crept aft through the darkness. Deadlight ship long since, and the air that came blasting down was charged with shattered water, not light. And to them were brought the injured men. One from the wheel, his ribs cracked by the flying spokes. A small light reefer dashed by the wind against the hanses, and now limp, insensible. Mr. Peter, who had made the same plunge as Stephen, though less luckily, more ribs, some broken limbs. Then, as lightning struck the ship, three men quite dazed, and one with a shocking burn dead before they brought him below. Bandaging, splinting, operating in a space that heaved through 45 degrees in all directions, and on chests that shifted and slid beneath them, they worked on and on. At one point a messenger from the quarter-deck came with the Commodore's compliments and was all well, together with something about 8 hours. And then, much, much later, when the ship had been on a comparatively even keel for some time, with no new cases coming below and the last of the fractured clavicles reduced, there was the Commodore himself, streaming wet in his shirt and breeches. He looked round, spoke to those casualties in any condition to hear him, and then in a hoarse voice he said to Stephen, "If you have a moment at any time, Doctor, you'll find a curious sight on deck." Stephen finished his bandage with a neat double turn and made his way up through the small hole in the canvas-covered hatch. He stood blinking in the extraordinary orange-tawny light, bracing himself against the flying air as solid as a wall. "The lifeline, sir," cried a seaman, putting it into his hand. "Clap under the lifeline for all love." "Thank you, friend," said Stephen, gazing about him. And as he spoke, he realized that the enormous, universal roar had diminished. It was now slightly less than that of continuous battle at close quarters. The Boadicea was lying to under a scrap of mizzen staysail, riding the tremendous seas nobly, shouldering them aside with her bluff bows. Her fore and main topmasts had gone by the board. Wild ropes by the score stretched horizontally aft from the wrecked tops, sometimes cracking as loud as a gun. Her remaining shrouds were packed with scraps of seaweed and pieces of terrestrial vegetation. A palm frond was clearly recognisable. But this was not the curious sight. From the drowned forecastle aft, and particularly on the quarterdeck, wherever there was the slightest lee, there were birds. Seabirds, for the most part, but right by him a little creature like a thrush. It didn't move as he approached it, nor even when he touched its back. The others were the same, and he looked into the lustrous eye of a bosun bird within a few inches. In this unearthly, lurid glow, it was hard to make out their true colours or their kind, but he did distinguish a white-headed noddy, scarcely to be seen within 5,000 miles of the Mauritius. As he was struggling towards it, a sort of growl in the orange clouds immediately above overcame the general roar, and in a second it was followed by a thunder so intolerably vast that it filled all the air about him. And with the thunder, a blaze of lightning struck the ship again. He was flung down, and picking himself up with a confused recollection of a triple stroke, of a forward gun having gone off, blasting out its port lid, he crawled below to wait for the wounded. There were no wounded. Instead, there appeared a piece of jellied veal brought by Killick with the message that the Thunderbolt had made hay of the best bower anchor, but otherwise all was well, that unless they were taken aback in the next hour or so, the Commodore thought they might be through the worst of it, and that he hoped Dr. Maturin might see better weather in the morning. Having slept like a corpse through the middle watch, and having attended his urgent cases at first light, Dr. Maturin did indeed see better weather when he came on deck. The sky was the most perfect blue, the sun delightfully warm, the gentle southeast wind refreshing. There was an enormous swell, but no white water. And apart from the desolation of the deck, the steady gush of the pumps, and the worn look of all hands, yesterday might have been a nightmare out of time. Yet there were other proofs. Mr. Trollope, the second lieutenant, limped up to him and pointed out two ships of the squadron, far, far to leeward. The Magicienne with her mizzen gone, and the Sirius with no topmast standing.
"Where is the Commodore?"
asked Stephen.
"He turned in half a glass ago. I begged him to get some sleep.
But before he went below, he told me to take care to show you the best bower. A most amazing philosophical sight." Stephen considered the fused, distorted metal and said, "We seem to be heading south. Southwest, as near as ever we can, with our compasses run mad because of the lightning. Southwest for the Cape to refit. And don't we wish we may get there?"